Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again.
Unbelievable.
Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake.
A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe in myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to episode 221, excuse me, of the Last Round Podcast. Thank you again for joining us. We have an interview this week with our guest of the week and LA Times reporter Melody Gutierrez. That will be towards the end of the episode. So if you don't want to hear me and Mike talk about the fights and news, you can skip this. Hopefully you don't, but you could skip this. It's towards the last 30 minutes or so of this episode. But jumping right back into it, fight reviews this past Saturday, the 13th of May, from the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas, Nevada, on Showtime Network. It's Showtime. They're still going. Who knows if they'll be like HBO, but they're still out there, Mike. Rolando Rolly Romero gets the 15th victory of his career with a 9th round TKO over Ismael Barroso, who takes the 4th loss of his career. Romero is now the WBA super lightweight champion of the world. Barroso was ahead on the judges' scorecards at the time of the stoppage by scores of 76-75, 77-74, and 78-73. Okay. You've been waiting hours, Mike, to talk about this fight. Now's your time. What did you think about this fight?
Well, where do you start?
You start wherever you want.
I thought Barroso, going into the fight, I thought he had a chance, but then when I saw him on the weigh-in day and saw him on fight day, I was like, you know what? His body's looking kind of old now, looking kind of soft. But yeah, he kind of really schooled Romero, to be honest with you. Ahead on the scorecards at the time, you know, he knocked Rolly down and then Rolly threw Barroso to the floor. Tony Weeks, for some reason, you know, called that a knockdown, which let Rolly back into the fight. And then, yeah, just going into, the 9th round? Into the 9th round, he's in the corner, kind of riding the punches. I don't think Romero really hit him with one flush punch during that combination. And then Tony Weeks steps in and stops the fight. And I don't really know what can we say. You know, it's been said all over Twitter, all over social media. It's either Tony Weeks just had a really bad angle and he's getting old and he needs to retire. Or are we going to use the C word? Are we going to call it corruption like everyone else is on Twitter? Because this is the second time it's happened to Rolly. If you remember correctly, he fought Jackson Marinez for the first time when he won the interim WBA title at 135. Ridiculous scorecard. I even went back and I retweeted some of them. I think it was CompuBoxes. I went back and I saw that what he tweeted back in, I think it was 2020. And I retweeted that. He was robbed that time as well. Jackson Marinez should have won on points. They gave it to Rolly, and then this is the second time. So I'm guessing Rolly obviously puts bums on seats and he puts eyes on the TV because they haven't hidden it. It looks like they're trying to do Rolly against Ryan Garcia.
He touched on the word corruption, which a lot of people on boxing Twitter and boxing forums right now are touching. You know, the word comes up a couple times a year. But this time, man, let me ask you this, Mike. Obviously, if you go to any other countries, you know, lesser developed countries, I guess, corruption is pretty likely, if not guaranteed. But in the United States, especially somewhere like Vegas, California, New York, where there's a lot of fights, you know, big states, they get a lot of business, a lot of tourism and stuff. You would think the word corruption wouldn't be used anymore, or you wouldn't have the need to say it out loud. What do you think, if any, how much corruption currently happens in boxing in the United States? And I'm talking about, like, obviously primarily California, Nevada, New York. Is it still prevalent? Is it still there?
Do you mean by, like, fixing fights? Is that what you mean by the corruption
yeah,
side?
Yeah, I mean, because if we're talking about this Romero victory.
You think it would happen on the small events, right? If it was going to happen, you know, because...
Where there's no eyeballs?
Yeah. You think, you know, betting syndicate would get some guy to take a dive or whatever, you know, or choose a round to go down in so they can put some money on at the bookies and, you know, do it that way. But when you've got hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people, you know, watching fights, it's you wouldn't think they'd do it like that because of, you know, the amount of people that are going to call you out and stuff like that. And, you know, I think we're just talking about corruption. I'm sure me and you aren't accusing Tony Weeks of corruption for people that are listening to this. I'm assuming it's not corruption because you wouldn't do it like that in front of all those people, would you? You know,
but it was just so, it was so blatant. I mean, I see your point. How you say you wouldn't do it in such a big stage like that, but it's, maybe it was a, I don't know, because you're right. Tony Weeks has been a referee for a long time. He's done some of the biggest fights, but he's been, you know, maybe he's just lost a step. But, you know, we kind of have to be realistic about it. It's just like that was, you know, did he know maybe, oh, man, Rolly's losing this fight. He's been knocked down. There's a chance he can lose his fight. I need to find a way to take it out of the judge's hands. I mean, the only thing I can think of, if there's no financial corruption behind it, alleged, is, you know, obviously in bigger profile fights, and we know this, the A side and the B side, A side mostly, gets to pick the referee or have a say in the referee, or both the A side and the B side have a say in the referee choice.
The referee's appointed and they can...
They can object.
Yeah, they can object. It's probably a good way to say, yeah.
Right. But I'm talking about, like, for example, Floyd Mayweather. Very easy example. Kenny Bayless was always a referee for a lot of his fights. Like the last, you know, eight to ten, I don't know how many years. The last couple years of his career. Kenny Bayless was always the guy. To the point where people are like, oh, Bayless again. He Mayweather, you know, he likes Mayweather and it works out. Do you think maybe these referees allegedly, you know, we'll throw that out there, they know they're getting these big assignments, but it's also like, oh, okay, well, guys like Mayweather and these bigger profile names don't object to me when I get chosen. So I always get these assignments. So that means they like me. Maybe I kind of give them the nod if I have the chance or something like that. Maybe there's no money at all. Maybe it's just like a fanboy thing.
I can see where you're coming from, you know, because to put it for our UK listeners, it's like it always seems to be, you know, the big name soccer teams, and I'm sure it's probably the same in football and in the NFL. The big teams always seem to get the rub of the green. You know, they always seem to get those big decisions go in their favor, and I guess it's a similar thing, you know, in boxing. Like, is it easier for him to, you know, kind of unconsciously or consciously, you know, favor Rolly Romero, you know, whether it's just the crowd or whatever, you know, doing the A side, B side type of thing. It's hard to say, isn't it? It's hard to say, but it does seem to, with the mistake being that big, it's either, you know, he's up to the end, maybe of his referee career. I mean, he's not doing it as well. He's not seeing it as well. He's not reacting like he should be, or he's seeing things that aren't there. You know, if we're going to side with him and say it wasn't, you know, corruption, because that was it was pretty bad, you know, like
it was really bad. That's why it's kind of like we're trying to be reasonable here, but it's really hard to be reasonable after you watch that footage. It's really hard to be reasonable. Like, it's hard to say, like, yeah, man, I don't know how you did that.
I can't remember that. Do you remember? So I saw someone posted on Twitter about it saying that Tony Weeks was the referee for the big fight where Yelena Nesanov got injured. And remember, he got injured after the fight and he was in hospital for a long time. So people were saying that, you know, that he he was off work for a while, came back, did some smaller fights, I believe, in Las Vegas. And then I think this was actually his first fight back since that incident. So maybe that was in the back of his mind. You know, he maybe thought that Barroso, from the angle he was at, was taking some punishment. And maybe he was just a little bit too quick on stepping in because of that injury that happened last time. Maybe now he doesn't want to let fights go as long as, you know, he should have done. We're trying to give him some type of example of something that he may have done, may have gone through his mind.
I mean, that's possible. And also, Barroso is in his 40s.
And even though he was winning the fight, he does look old, right? He
did
look
old. And I mean, that was if you're on boxing Twitter and all that stuff, that was a narrative that was going around
this whole last week. His dad.
You know, like jokes around about at his age, like, who is Rolly Romero fighting? Do you know, Luis Ortiz's dad? And this guy's fighting, you know. I know Romero was initially supposed to fight, who was he supposed to fight? But it didn't work out.
Puello?
Alberto Puello?
Yeah, that's
it. Yeah. But that, didn't they commission not authorize him as an opponent or what happened?
He tested positive in a test, and then his team said it was just a faux pas on some paperwork. He was taking something medically.
Yeah.
And then, but then it came out saying it was Clomid, the same thing that Conor Benn tested positive for. So I don't know why he would be taking that. But his team initially said it was a medication they forgot to list, and it was their fault. It was a camp thing. So I'm sure we'll hear about the investigation on that, and then... You know, I'm sure Rolly is kind of technically, I think he is a WBA champion. Initially, they were saying interim, and then they said he actually is the champion. And I believe Polo's WBA champion in recess until the end of this investigation.
Right, right. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe the commission or Tony Weeks was aware about, like, oh, this guy's older. Maybe I should look at it. And I know people are just like, oh, you guys should just call it out. We're just trying to give any possible, if there's any possible reasoning for the stoppage. Obviously, I think we both agree that watching the footage is just like, man, it's hard to defend that. It's like something was going on. But if there's anything, obviously we're speculating on the mentality of Tony Weeks or maybe the commission, maybe they had a conversation before, like, hey, this guy's older. He's fighting a young guy, you know, a powerful young kid. And Rolly can hit hard. He punches pretty hard. And maybe they're like, hey, you know, let's keep a closer eye on Barroso, just in case, you know, because obviously referees get criticized one way or the other. They get criticized if they stop it too late or if they stop it too early. We see criticisms more for either of those conclusions than we do of, oh, that was a perfect stoppage. That's what we see. So, you know, you're going to have bad nights as a referee when you do it that long. But us being in this boxing sphere and, you know, being hardcore fans, we know Rolly Romero is, you know, especially now being essentially the only dedicated name to Mayweather Promotions. I know Tank Davis is still there, but there was no Mayweather promotion banner at the Ryan Garcia fight, so their cut doesn't seem like it's that big anymore, if at all. But Romero is the guy, you know, and I'm sure Showtime, Espinoza, like, oh yeah, we need to try to elevate this guy, or, you know, Mayweather Promotions. And you're right, I think they're trying to entice a Ryan Garcia fight in the future, Rolly versus Ryan, you know, like, oh, you both lost a Tank, let's put them together. Let's see if Ryan's a free agent or not. If he is, or if he's not, you know, De La Hoya is going to try to block that. I don't think he's going to want to do another fight with Showtime for a while.
Well, I'm guessing he's a free agent after that post that we put out from Marco Viejas's interview with Oscar, some of the stuff that he was saying.
You're right. It's a chance that he is, but Oscar did say at the beginning of the interview, he's like, oh no, me and Ryan have a lot of things cooking, or something like that, saying we have a lot of plans and people try to divide us with the stuff they say. So, that was kind of like, I took it as him saying, like, oh yeah, like, we're still together. We still have plans for the future. We're still going to do something. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he was just talking, but who knows? Who knows? But, yeah, man, the Tony Weeks, that looked like a lot of home cooking for the A side guy, which is Rolly Romero. And he was losing on scorecards. He was, you know.
Are you surprised that Nevada have not come out and said anything? They've made no statement that I was looking
for. Well, they really never do. They really never. When's the last time we really heard from Nevada, the Nevada commission, whether it was a referee or somebody, the executive officer or something? Like, we talk about, so our guests later on in the episode, for our listeners right now, we touch on the executive officer of the California State Athletic Commission, Andy Foster, and how the LA Times investigative reporter Melody Gutierrez talked to him multiple times about her boxer pension story in California. Andy Foster has been on our podcast on the Last Round two or three times over the last 3 or 4 years or so. But Andy Foster is very open to the media. He'll talk to you. You know, he's reasonable. He'll, you know, every time we've reached out to him to try to schedule him, the two or three times that we've had him, he always finds time to jump on the show, which is great, you know? But if you compare that to the Nevada State Athletic Commission, I mean, when's the last time we really heard from them? I mean, was it Bob Bennett? Bob Bennett hasn't been there for years, but Bob Bennett did at least sometimes talk to the media. But he's not the head anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he would email us back when we emailed him.
Yeah. We were trying to get him on too, and we were trying to coordinate, but then the schedules never lined up. But we should try again.
He pulled out last minute.
He did, yeah. We had him scheduled at one point, and he backed out right at the end. So we're like, but we should try again now that you mentioned that. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's just how they work. They're like, oh, no, don't give any interviews and stuff. You know, over here, like I say, in comparison to California, Jack Reese, for example, referee out here in California, he gives a lot of interviews. He's been on our show multiple times. Ray Corona, he's been on our show before.
Jack Reese just called me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And this actually just happened right now as we're recording this. He called you.
I had to stop it because it would have popped up on the screen.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, you'll get back to him. You'll get back to him. But yeah, you know, I guess it just depends on the agency culture. You know, California Commission and the Nevada Commission are just a little bit different in regards to media attention and media interviews. But I don't know. The Tony Weeks decision to stop that fight, it's hard to defend him. It's really hard. It's very, very hard to defend it. What was before this? Was the last one? When's the last time you felt like this, where you felt like, wow, like that word corruption is, it's pretty close to be used here.
It's, I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Because normally we blame the judges. It's normally when it goes to the scorecards. It's rare do we see something as outlandish as that. Is that the right word to use? You know,
yeah.
Something where you jump in and you're like, "What the hell? Did he really just stop that?" I couldn't even tell you. I'd have to do some research. The only one I remember watching it recently, where I was like, "What the hell?" is probably the Jack Catterall, Josh Taylor, and that was scorecards. That wasn't, you know, that wasn't a referee stepping in, to the point where I was kind of like, what the hell? He's got that wrong.
Well, just imagine, like you said, on these scorecards, Barroso was ahead on all three of them. Just imagine if Romero was ahead on all three of them, and not just by like 1 point or so, but like a significant margin, like multiple points. That also would have got attention. Like, oh, they were all in on the fix. You know, they were all working together. But if there's any silver lining here, the judges had it right at the point of the stoppage. Cause I think Barroso, you know, was probably winning the fight.
The least they should do is, if they're not going to, you know, call the fight like a no contest or whatever, cause I've never seen that in boxing, right? You never see that.
No.
Rematch.
Yeah. But I mean, get Barroso another payday at least.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's the least you could do for the guy.
Yeah,
but I think Romero beats him easily in the next one, because I think he's going to be more prepared. I think Romero sometimes, like, he buys into his own hype sometimes, and he probably just didn't take this guy seriously, and he got caught. You know, so, but I think in the rematch, I mean, give Barroso the payday, least you could do. But I think Romero, you know, wins easily in the next one. But yeah, man, that's hard to defend Tony Weeks here. It really is.
Like I say, to set the record kind of straight, if you can, you know, him and Ryan start going at it. Ryan needs to come back, right? Ryan has a comeback fight with Tito Hester, whoever. Rowley fights Barroso. They both set the record straight. He gets in the W. Ryan gets a W. They've kind of already said, like, hey, you win. We face each other.
Yeah.
You get a bit of build-up. Ryan gets to get back into the win column after losing to Javonte, you know, and then, you know, everyone's back on kind of like the path that they should have been on before, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, that was definitely one for the history books right there. That was not good. Not good for the sport at all. In the co-main event, Kenneth Sims Jr. gets the majority decision win in a tough fight over, all right, take this one, Mike. Pronounce the name.
Akhmadov? I can't pronounce the first name.
I know, that's why I didn't give it a shot. So Akhmadov, who takes the third professional loss of his career. What did you think about this fight?
Contender for fight of the year. But
yeah, it was a close fight. It was a good fight.
Just because it's not got a big name in it, I'm sure we won't see it on there at the end of the year. But so far, it was a really, really good fight. And, you know, going to the scorecards, you know, looking at Twitter, both people were kind of stuck either way because, you know, Sims Jr. Probably threw less, but was pretty accurate when he did throw. But Akhmadov was probably, I would have said, the busier fighter and maybe not necessarily as much power on the punches and stuff like that, and but always hitting clean, but he was a lot more active. And I actually thought he was going to take it. That's just, I tend to prefer an active fighter. You know, when I'm watching, I found that that's what I always seem to side with. So that's who I actually thought was going to take it this one.
And then also this past weekend from the Stockton Arena in Stockton, California on ESPN, Jason Maloney, Australia's Jason Maloney, gets the majority decision win over Vincent Astrolabio, who takes the fourth professional loss of his career. Maloney wins the vacant WBO bantamweight world title by scores of 115, 113, 116, 112, and also 114, 114. What did you think about Maloney's win?
Wasn't the best for TV, but he had a very, very good game plan, stuck to it, and it worked. And if you want to come away with the world championship like he did, then just stick to that game plan, you know, because you could see at the end when the scores were read out, the crowd weren't overly, you know, happy with the result. It just seemed that, you know, Maloney was kind of happy to sit there, go through the game plan, box very, very smart, whereas Astrolabio, I believe it's pronounced, he was just kind of looking for that one hit or quitter. He was just kind of like relying on his power, but Maloney was too smart to ever kind of like sit there and let him, you know, tee off. So it was a good, I suppose, over the seas victory, right? He comes over, gets his game plan, takes the belt back to Australia.
And the fight, and for the hometown crowd or the home crowd right there in Stockton, California, the fight was booed pretty loudly in the main event. Because like you said, it didn't really have the entertainment factor. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of people like to see knockouts, like the action. You know, it's just what it is when you pay money to go watch a fight. But, I mean, I think we touched on last week that it was kind of strange that these two fighters, or an Australian fighter who was the A side in the main event here, was fighting in Stockton, California. Mm-hmm. You know, I know they had I think we'll touch on it in a second. But they had Gabriel Flores, who's from Stockton, California. So maybe they thought, okay, he should bring some people in. I don't think he brought a ton of people in, but you know, he brings maybe something.
First round knockout.
He did, yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's still young, man. It could work out. You never know. But yeah, I thought it was a strange main event in a strange city. But I mean, ESP or Top Rank doesn't want to go all the way to Australia for a fight like this. And, you know, maybe they just needed a venue. They're like, okay, let's just go right there. You know, it's not that far. You know, I'm surprised they didn't put it like in Vegas or something. I don't know. Maybe they thought Stockton, you know, they don't get that many fights or as many fights as other locations. So they thought, oh, they'll show up for fights.
I'm with you. I don't. When they stick them in these random places, I'm like, why don't you just go to like a boxing hotbed like Vegas or in New York? Or if you're not having a hometown fighter there to sell the tickets, just go to somewhere where the fans are going to show up because they're all boxing fans. Stick it at the StubHub Center. Stick it downtown LA, you know, somewhere like that.
People, yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, or but maybe Stockton, maybe the site fee for the venue in Stockton was cheaper than the StubHub Center in Carson, California or something. I don't know. I feel like LA would be a lot more expensive.
Oh, 100%. You're not wrong there.
Oh, and you know, all these promoters, especially Top Rank, like they look at the bottom line. So, you know, maybe that there was some financial incentive behind it, obviously. So we'll see how it all plans out. And also on the card, excuse me, Zanabek remains undefeated at 14-0 with the first round knockout over Stephen Butler. This was for the WBO middleweight title. What'd you think about Zanabek's win?
Just caught him, and that was all that she wrote. Caught him with a good
Zanabek. Is it Zanabek or Zanabek? Sorry.
It's pronounced with a J.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Well, with a Z, I believe, but they pronounce it with a J.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Good performance from him. Caught him early on, and then just jumped in and finished him off. Some, should we say, brave refereeing from Jack Reese. And, you know, I know some people gave him some stick for it, saying I don't think he should have had to have been dropped for the third time, but me and you spoke about it, you know, before we started recording, and I think me and you were both kind of fine with it, right? You know, the end of the day.
I was good with it.
Yeah, I mean, the corner team can always throw it in if it gets to the point where, you know, they think the referee should stop it and the referee doesn't look like he's going to. You know, they can always call the fight off themselves. So, yeah, I didn't see anything wrong with it. It wasn't one of those ones where I was kind of shutting my eyes like, oh, no, don't let him back in, you know. It wasn't one of those. So I thought it was a good fight for Zanabek, another easy win. You could hardly put a sweat on, right? She could be back out fighting again in another 2-3 months.
Right. Yeah. No, yeah. I thought, going back to the Jack Reese stoppage, I thought it was a fine stoppage. I was okay with it. I don't want to say it's fine. I was okay with it. You know, I didn't really see any issue with it. I think it would have got maybe a little bit more attention if Tony Reeks wasn't already the center of attention for the Rolly Romero fight. So maybe kind of took a little bit of the edge off, or a little bit of attention off of Jack Reese's stoppage there. So, but yeah, I was okay with it. So, Zanabek gets the WBO middleweight world title. Was this a full title, or are we talking interim, or what's going on here?
Full title.
It is, right? Yeah. I feel like all these, the middleweight titles are all over the place now. You know, ever since Canelo and Triple G are all out of there, they're like, oh, no, now it's all over the place. Charlo or whatever's going on. So, speaking of Charlo, I don't know why he's not been stripped. It's been like 3 years or whatever. It's ridiculous.
I read, they said mental health now.
Oh, really?
WBC, I believe. I think it was Suleiman put out a thing on Twitter today saying that, I think people were complaining, and he said that they didn't strip him due to hasn't fought for a period of time.
I know, but like these sanctioning bodies, sometimes there's times where they haven't stripped other fighters, and they didn't mention anything about mental health.
Leo Santa Cruz didn't fight for what, over 2 years?
Yeah. What about Leo Santa Cruz? Mm-hmm. You know, if they come out with a statement like that, then okay, you're treating it all the same. But, you know, yeah, people, like I said, we've had people on before who told us off the record, I guess, if you want to say it, that, these rankings and these sanctioning bodies, like, oh yeah, if you just want somebody higher in the rankings, you just make a call and boom, and some other stuff happens. Yeah. So, you know, it is what it is. That's just the nature of the sport. It's unfortunate, but that's what happens. Moving on to fight previews. It's upcoming Saturday, the 20th of May, from the 3 Arena in Dublin, Ireland, on DAZN. Chantel Cameron, 17-0, goes up against Katie Taylor, 22-0, a battle of undefeated for the undisputed super lightweight titles of the world. Battle of undefeated, Mike. Who wins? What do you got?
I'm going to go with Katie Taylor. I know she looked a little bit over the hill when she fought Serrano in that great fight over in New York. You know, she started really well, kind of faded in the mid rounds, and then somehow, some way, managed to pull it out of the bag in the last few rounds and probably take the fight, you know, right then and there. I just think she's, hopefully, if Father Time's not caught up with her, she's a little bit more active, a little bit cleaner work, a little bit more powerful shots, even though I think, you know, Cameron is the bigger fighter. She's just a better all-round boxer, I think. I know Cameron keeps saying that she's the better brawler or the overall, but I think at the end of the day, I think Taylor's going to win it by just being more clean and effective.
Is Cameron English?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
She's from Manchester, I believe.
So I think you're right. I think I'm leaning towards Katie Taylor as well. But I think the X factor is going to be she's in her – it's a hometown fight. That crowd is going to be 1,000% behind her. So I think that's going to give her the edge. But I do think that, you know, she's kind of getting towards the end of the career.
Do you disagree if I said that she's the real GOAT?
Huh. I'm going to reach out to Carissa Shields to get her on. You're going to tell her that. See what she says to you. I'm going to do it.
If she wins this, and she'll be two-weight undisputed.
But what about Amanda? What about Amanda Serrano?
She, honestly, in my opinion, one of those two should be, because Carissa Shields is undisputed in a weight category that literally has 9 fighters.
I mean, yeah, you kind of have to look at it like that. Yeah. You know, I mean, Carissa Shields is a gold medalist from the Olympics, so that obviously gives her a lot of credibility. But
so is Taylor.
That's right. So is Taylor. Amanda Serrano isn't, but Amanda Serrano is how many?
Eight
different weight classes.
Yeah.
That's extremely impressive. That's in weight Manny Pacquiao, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Serrano's done it in weight divisions where there is competition, because unfortunately for Shields, she's just at a heavier weight classes where there isn't any fighters. Whereas Katie Taylor, Amanda Serrano, they've done it at weight classes where there's pages and pages of women fighters on BoxRec.
Yeah, that's true. And that's just a fact, too. That's just with how the boxing landscape is structured. So, yeah, if you want to look at it like that, yeah, that's the nature of the game right now. In the co-main event, Dennis Hogan. You might remember Dennis Hogan's name. I think he fought Jaime Munguia, right? 31.
Robbery?
What?
That was a robbery.
Yeah, that's a good touch right now. Dennis Hogan, a lot of people thought he won that fight. 31-4-1 goes up against James Metcalf, 24-2. This is for the IBO, super welterweight title of the world. IBO making an appearance. What do you think about this fight?
You know what? When I see fights like this, I'm kind of pleased that we have that fifth title. So when you get people like Metcalf and Hogan that have been around, they fought everybody. You know, unfortunately, they weren't good enough to win one of the bigger name, you know, world titles. It's kind of cool that we get these little fights, you know, between these guys that are on kind of like lower down. You know, they still get to pick up a strap and, you know, stuff like that. So it's going to be a good fight. I remember James Metcalf when he was coming through, and, you know, people said he was going to, he had some real potential. Unfortunately, he just didn't, you know, manage to fulfill it. But, you know, this is a big fight on a outstanding stage for these two. To be in the island on Katie Taylor's, like, homecoming, the crowd is going to be electric. Asking me to pick, I think I'm going to go Hogan.
Hulk Hogan. Yeah, maybe I'll go for him too. Also on the card, Terry Harper, 13-1-1, goes up against the first lady of boxing, Cecilia Breakhus, 37-2. This is for the WBA super welterweight title. What do you think about this fight?
It's all in. What does Cecilia Breakhus have left?
She's still going. Well, we saw her, or I saw her in the Commerce Casino. It was a Golden Boy event. I was right there around the media scrum interviewing her about her fight and, you know, some other stuff she's looking forward to. And she said she still wants to keep going. And she's been staying pretty consistently active. You got to give her that.
Yeah. I mean, she's 41 now. So she is coming close to retirement, right? You would imagine. But this, I mean, it's going to be hard for her. You know, that's all that she's known for, what, like 20-something years? She really was, I suppose the name kind of says it, doesn't it? She was the first lady of women's boxing. She was the one that, you know, actually made it legal in, you know, the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, that's big, man.
She wanted to box. So it's an interesting one, because Terry Harper doesn't have much power. Obviously, she's moving up. Terry Harper did move up, should I say. So it's going to be interesting just to see, you know, what Terry Harper's like at this this weight class against someone like a Cecilia Breakhus. And this, I suppose, just sit back and enjoy, because it could be the last time we see Cecilia.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a pretty interesting matchup. I really do.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, she's only ever lost to Jessica McCaskill, right? That's her only two losses.
Yeah, I think so.
McCaskill twice.
Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah, definitely an intriguing matchup there. Also, this upcoming Saturday, one of the probably most, hopefully most competitive fights of the year, from the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas on ESPN Plus, a pay-per-view. I believe it's an ESPN Plus pay-per-view. Devin Haney, the undisputed lightweight champion of the world, 29-0, goes up against high-tech Vasily Lomachenko, 17-2, the former undisputed lightweight champion of the world. The biggest question is, Mike, are we still going to see the same Lomachenko?
That's the thing. That's the thing. I'm really looking forward
to this. That's the big question mark. That's the big question mark.
It always is when you see people coming to the end of their career, right? Because you don't know, like, okay, was that last fight, was it injury? Was it father time? And you always think back to those good days, right? Of watching Loba kind of just bebop around the ring, being super fast, all these, you know, crazy angles and stuff like that, punching you from all over. And then people just quitting because they're getting, trying to chase a fly around their body. You know, they're just getting picked all over. So it's, it'd be interesting to see. It's going to be hard because you just don't know what Loma's left, but I'll be honest with you.
That's the thing. Like, I still feel that he's going to have enough tools from what we think Loma is to give Haney problems. I think so. It might not be the same, but I still think he's going to be dangerous.
My head says Haney, younger, fresher, also bigger, stronger. But my heart, because of the fact how much I just loved watching Lomachenko, my heart says Loma, just that thing of like a movie, just one last time, one last show, one last to the well, fill the bucket up.
You think if he gets all the belts? You think if he loses, he retires?
I don't know, because he has a very stubborn attitude, doesn't he? He kind of like him and Canelo have a very stubborn attitude. Because I think he's even said, I think he said in an interview this week, in his head, he's never lost. He doesn't believe he lost to Salido, and he doesn't believe that he lost to Teofimo Lopez. Right. And I guess you just have to have that, right? To do what he's done, to do what someone like he's done and Canelo's done, you have to have that belief that you've never lost or that you can do it and you'll get revenge. Look at Canelo now. Everybody's telling him not to fight Bivol. And what does he do? He's like, okay, that's who I want to fight. And that's probably because people are telling him not to, because he's that sort of person. And I think it's I think it's similar with Lomachenko. Like, he wants to show people, like, because how long have we been saying he shouldn't even be at this weight division?
Yeah, this is his ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I haven't even thought about this till just now. Who's bigger, Haney or Teofimo? Because
Are we talking about overall?
Like, just bigger, like body wise, because people were saying like he lost.
I think it's Teofimo. I think it's Teofimo. Bigger.
I think, have to look at a picture.
I think so.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting fight. But that, my head says Haney, but my heart wants Loma.
I think it's, yeah, I think because it's like, we don't know if Lomachenko still has the same, the fact that we're just like, yeah, he could still be the same guy, or he could still have enough to be dangerous. But it also could be the other way around. Like, oh, maybe he's not going to be the same. It's that's making it more intriguing, you know? You got to give it to Haney too. Like, I know he has a top rank deal, so they're trying to make, you know, they're making their house. I think this is his last fight on the contract, but maybe there's a rematch clause. Who knows? But you got to give it to Haney. I know people don't give him too much credit for the George Kambosos wins, but he went to Australia twice and he beat him twice. Yeah. He got the titles, and now he's fighting Lomachenko. Haney's showing, you know, he might not be Tank Davis, you know, high profile, which people look at Tank Davis as like, oh, he's the man at 135. But when you look at accolades, Haney's the man right now. He's got all the titles.
Two things. You have to give, out of the new guys coming through, you have to give respect to Devin Haney and Shakur, because they seem to call people out and then they fight them.
Yeah.
You know, they're not just all talk, you know, like some of the other guys that we've seen, I guess. What was I going to say? I do feel that Lomachenko must be like at least 90%, because kind of like when you see like the Eastern kind of block fighters, you know, those guys, they don't ever really just turn up to the ring just for a payday. I don't see Loma and his dad letting Loma get into the ring at like 90% and kind of making a mockery of the stuff that he's already done before on his career.
Right.
They seem like the uber serious sort of people where like if he was like a shell of what he used to be, where his dad would be like, no, you're not getting in the ring.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. I feel like they have that type of discipline in that training camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I always remember watching the fight in Loma. It might have been when he fought Linares or someone. He won and he ran to like the corner. He was going to climb up on the ropes. And somebody in his team stuck a fake crown on top of his head. And his dad ran over and took it off him.
You know,
as if to say, like, no, like, that's not how we do it. Like, we don't celebrate like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Ripped it off his head. And then,
like Ryan Garcia?
Yeah, like a crown, kind of like that. Yeah, just someone put it on his head. Someone,
funny talking about Ryan Garcia, you know, same division and stuff. Remember when he came out, I think it was a Texas fight, whoever he fought, was it Campbell? Remember when he came out on that throne with the crown? He said that, I think, in one of the interviews leading up to the Tank Davis fight, he's like, yeah, I'm never going to do that again. Because I think he, like, his head, you know, he bought into his own hype. Mm. And he won the fight, but he got knocked down by Campbell. And it was, you know, it was an entertaining fight. But he said that in an interview leading up to the Tank Davis fight. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm never going to do that again. Like, he thought, like, oh, yeah, I bought into my own hype. And I shouldn't have done that.
Mm.
So maybe that's how Lomachenko's dad is and his team. They're like, oh, no, we're not going to. That's not how we are. So, which kind of fits their narrative because they kind of, you know, Lomachenko, Canelo, like, are arguably the two most disciplined fighters in the sport, like at the highest level.
Well, that's one of the reasons they're at the highest level, right?
Right, right. So, yeah. But undisputed lightweight title fight, it's an undisputed fight. I mean, this is great for boxing fans. This is awesome. We've been getting a lot of undisputed fights the last couple of years. And these are two of the best 135 pounders in the world going at it.
So not long after seeing Ryan Garcia, Gervonta Davis.
It's been
a good year so far.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm definitely excited. And the co-main event, Junto Nakatani, 24-0, goes up against Andrew Maloney. Maloney fighting a week after his brother just fought this past weekend. This is for the vacant WBO super flyweight title of the world. What do you think about this fight?
I think the Maloney household could be on fire in the space of what, a week?
That's what they want. That's what they want.
From zero world champions to two world champions, and probably both underdogs as well.
And I'm pretty sure Top Rank would then make an Australian fight. They would go to Australia and have them both on the card.
And then chuck some money at Kambosos and you're good to go, right?
Yeah, put them all on the same card.
Yeah.
You can get a pretty good crowd down there. You could, yeah. Yeah, this is a pretty interesting fight too, but you're right. I think Maloney, he's going to try really hard. He's like, oh, my brother just won. He's a champion now. Man, week later.
Mm.
But Nakatani's undefeated. So
it's a tricky fight, you know. Nakatani, I think, goes in probably rightfully as the favorite.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You need an exact same performance from Maloney again. How we just said that it was a very good game plan, getting in, sticking to the game plan, staying away from the big shots, just working at it, which could make the fight very boring for the 12 rounds. But I honestly think you need a, as you say over here, like cookie cutter performance taken from last week to this week. By both Maloney brothers, and then we'll have two Maloney world champions.
Right. Yeah. That, in the span of 1 week, two double champions. That's crazy. Right.
Unbelievable.
And also another great matchup. It's a rematch, actually. They're running it back. Oscar Valdez, 30-1, former world champion, 126 and 130 pounds, goes up against Adam Blue Nose Lopez, 16-4. Lopez had not, I think in their first meeting, gave Valdez a pretty good fight. I think he knocked down Valdez. He ended up losing the fight, but it was a good, entertaining fight. Do we see anything similar again?
No. Unfortunately, though, as much as I like Lopez, he was on a kind of a good bit of form, and then he, you know, ran into Dog Bay, you know, lost a close decision to Dog Bay, and then somehow, some way, he managed to get this fight against Oscar Valdez, which is an unbelievable for him, a good payday for him. But I think Valdez will just be too big, too strong this time around. And I think it could be kind of like a similar performance where Lopez is kind of like winning on the cards and then unfortunately just gets stopped by Valdez, you know, late in the fight, unfortunately. That's going to hurt, dude, as well, because that's going to be, isn't that two back-to-back defeats for Adam?
Yeah. Yeah. But he's really that type of guy that, like, he's a good opponent to have. And I still feel he'll get fights, but you're right though. Like, you can only take so many losses, but look at Gabriel Zotto, you know, maybe Lopez could be like Gabriel Zotto. Who knows? Obviously he doesn't want to be or that many losses, but you can make a career. He doesn't have
that like fan, like friendly sort of. Rosado had that like villain, didn't he? It being the B side with his like kind of like his tats and the way that he spoke and being from like Philadelphia, like he kind of suited that B side kind of like hero villain type thing. Whereas Lopez isn't like a massive talker. He's not like super like charismatic or anything, just like a super nice guy. And he's the sort of thing, I think when you get a few too many losses, a lot of the promoters are just going to cut you loose because you don't really bring that much to the table anymore. I don't see Adam filling, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 seater stadiums by himself or anything like that. So,
right.
Made good for him to accept it, though. You know, I'm sure that it must be a good payday because it's Valdez's comeback fight.
Yeah. It's a good card, though. It's a good card. Like, they top rank did, because I thought about it too for a second as we were going through these fights. I was like, well, why wouldn't you put Valdez and Adam Lopez on the Stockton card that just happened in Stockton, California, you know? But I'm sure top Frank looked at it like, oh no, well, this is a pay-per-view fight to satisfy the purses for Haney and Lomachenko. So they had to try to stack it with competitive fights and some decent names to try to entice people to buy. So, I mean, I can see that. So who knows? News and notes section of this week's episode of The Last Round. Heavyweight Joe Joyce has exercised his rematch clause to return in a bout against Zhili Zhang, who got the upset win over him last month. Was it last month?
Yeah, sixth round stoppage last month.
Yeah. So this is according to ESPN. The 40-year-old Zhang, obviously, we just touched on, scored a massive upset when he stopped Joyce in the sixth round in their bout last month in London. Zhang is an Olympic silver medalist and is in the running to fight heavyweight champion Tyson Fury in July, supposedly. We'll see. We'll see if that happens. But Joyce does have the contractual rematch clause, so I don't think the Fury fight happens. I think Joyce gets a crack at it in the rematch first. Queensberry, obviously, Frank Warren is with Tyson Fury. But we'll see what happens there. And then Virgil Ortiz has been announced to return on July 8th, in his rescheduled bout with I can never say his first name. Stanionis. Obviously, Virgil Ortiz, this was the second time he had to, he suffered and he had to recover from how do you say it?
I would just say rhabdo.
Rhabdomyolysis. And then I think Virgil Ortiz's team had said that it was caused by long COVID symptoms. But I guess he's okay now and he's recovered, so which is good for him. But this is the second time that he's went through this. So, I mean, it's kind of concerning. So we'll see. We'll see how this works out. But yeah, that's definitely concerning when it's the second time in less than a year. And this is also at 147 pounds. Like, you know, Virgil Ortiz is getting older. Or, you know, he's growing into his man strength and getting older, and you can only get down to a certain weight for so long. So this fight's going to be in Texas. Ortiz is a home state of Texas. So both of the fighters are obviously in the top 10 rankings in a lot of these sanctioning bodies. So I believe Ortiz is number 3 on ESPN's rankings and Stanionis is number 6. This is at the AT&T Center in San Antonio, Texas. So we'll see. But I still think I think we've touched on before in the past. I don't think Ortiz is going to be able to get a title shot at 147 pounds because his body is not going to let him make that weight anymore. So he's going to be fighting at that weight class without having a title shot. He's going to have to move up to 154. I just don't see it. We don't see it.
Him and Lex.
Maybe. Yeah.
Get it made.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that's the last fight they do at 147 for Ortiz. But yeah, I just don't see it with all the titles being held up right now by Spence and Crawford trying to make that fight. And yeah, I just don't see it. You know, his body's not going to let him, but we'll see. We'll see how it works out. But now we are at the point, you know, obviously we conducted an interview with the LA Times investigative reporter, Melody Gutierrez. We touched on the boxing pension retirement in the state of California, which is the only state in the entire United States to have any type of program like that for boxers. We touched on her investigation into the pension, how it's working, any potential pitfalls, any concerns. She did talk to the executive officer of the California State Athletic Commission, Andy Foster. She said she had numerous Zoom calls with him. He was very open with her and, you know, answered her questions and stuff. And obviously we know that, you know, he's talked to us multiple times here on the last round. It was a very interesting conversation to have with her. She went into her investigation, fighters being owed money, the reaction of some fighters who she told that they had money waiting for them and they didn't know. And now some of them are like, oh, I can use that to, you know, to remodel my backyard or to do this or to do that. Or, you know, it's a very interesting conversation. And obviously it's a good program to have in California. Hopefully other states, at least the bigger states, would they get a lot of fights, kind of consider it. I know we touched on that. Some states have been discussing it for years, but it hasn't actually been officially implemented. But we'll see. Maybe with this LA Times investigation, maybe other states will notice and follow suit. So for once again, guys, we obviously appreciate you listening to this half of the Last Round podcast. And now here is our interview with the Los Angeles Times investigative reporter, Melody Gutierrez.
And now it's time for the Last Round interview of the week.
And now to our guest of the week. She is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times and recently conducted an LA Times investigation into California, the state of California, specifically the California State Athletic Commission's Boxer Pension Fund, with an article entitled "California Created the Nation's Only Pension for Aging Boxers, but it's failing many of them." LA Times reporter Melody Gutierrez joins us this week on the Last Round podcast. Thank you again, or not again, but thank you for joining us, Melody.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. So before we dive into your story and your investigation into this boxer pension in the state of California, can you tell us, you know, what your background is in journalism, you know, how many investigative stories you've done, how long you've been a writer, how long you've been interested, and are you a boxing fan for our boxing listeners?
I got into journalism originally 2 decades ago and was a sports reporter for a long time. So I covered MMA and the NBA and WNBA. I was kind of all over the place. But one of the things that I really enjoyed covering was mixed martial arts at the time, because the state had not yet, California had not yet regulated it. So I was there covering the transition from it being exclusively on tribal land in the state to being officially regulated by the California State Athletic Commission. And after covering sports for many years at the Sacramento Bee, I ended up getting into education reporting. And then after that, I became a political reporter and was a political reporter at the Sacramento Bee, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the LA Times. And in that political reporting, I specialized really in government accountability stories. And so that's where this story, I felt like, kind of hit kind of my sweet spot, because sports, you know, combat sports specifically, and the Athletic Commission, which I have written about in the past, and government accountability. And so it was kind of that perfect niche right there for me to jump into when I joined the investigative team at the LA Times in November. This was the first story that I took out of my folder and said, I want to do this. I want to look into this.
So it was your idea. You pitched that story idea to your team.
I did. It's actually been, there was an audit in 2005 that I printed out shortly after and stuck in a folder that has traveled with me from different jobs, different beats. And I knew that I eventually wanted to write the kind of story that takes months. Like that, the boxer's pension was never going to be something you could do as a quick hit. Because if you want to try to get a hold of boxers, it does take time. And to be able to get into pension policy and the specifics of this very unique pension was going to take a while. And so this was something kind of the LA Times invested in this to allow me to work exclusively on this story for months.
That's great. Cause we were talking about it, when you guys published these stories that, because a lot of boxing fans and us in the boxing media landscape, we've known about this for a while. But so when you guys wrote the story, we're like, oh, it's actually gaining some attention because it's, you know, it's not something that people know about. But that's because we were wondering like, oh, you know, I wonder how they kind of came up with the story idea. But it's very interesting. And for us as boxing fans, it's very nice to know that you had this story in your back pocket, shining a light on this. So that's pretty cool. So we know you talked about, you talked to several, or I would just say maybe more than a dozen different fighters, in regards to this investigation. Who was the first fighter that you contacted?
I think the first one that I got a hold of was Mike Jamison. And I think the thing that stood out to me about Irish Mike Jamison is one, I'm in Sacramento, that's where I'm based for the LA Times, and he's just in San Jose, so that's not too far of a distance. And he was so incredibly easy to find, and the fact that his pension's been sitting there, you know, he's 68 years old, he could have claimed it at 50. That's a long time for that money to sit there, and he had no idea it existed. So it was sort of the kind of perfect first interview, and he is just gregarious and a lovely human, who I just have come to adore. He's a very nice guy. Went out to his house and showed us around. He took the photographer to, he's a musician, so he took the photographer to one of his gigs, and so he was kind of the perfect guy to have as your first person to get a hold of.
Now, how did you decide on him being the first point of contact?
I was literally going through a list. So I put in a public records request to the Athletic Commission, because on their website for years, they've posted the athletes, the boxers who do qualify. And that was sort of how it was framed, is like, it, you know, click here to find out if you have pension benefits. But what it turned out is that list was, one, it was incomplete, but also it did not include anybody who was owed a pension. It just was people between the ages of 54 and older, who have late claims. And so it's like a special bucket of people whose money has then been forfeited back into another account. And it just got into the very complex nature of this specific pension. But I think a lot of the people who I ended up reaching out to said, well, I clicked that button and my name wasn't on there, so I assumed I wasn't owed benefits. And so when I reached out to Mike, part of the reason was I saw his name on that list, but also an older list that said that his pension had been reduced.
Just for the people who are listening, because I'm sure me and Danny know, but just give everyone a quick lowdown on how the pension actually works.
Yeah, so it was created in 1982, and it had been talked about in the state for many. I mean, I went to the state archives and found a bill from 1971 where they gave the original permission for the commission to create the pension. The commission ended up creating the pension in 1981. That's when they passed their regulations, went back to lawmakers. It became official in 1982. And that it's changed several times. So it's not the same pension that was passed in 1982. But today, if you fight 75 rounds in California, regardless of where you live, if you fight 75 rounds in California with no more than a 3-year break, then you qualify for these benefits. And then the amount you get is all dependent on how much money is in the pension fund, the purse of your fights, how many rounds you ended up fighting. It's a complex formula that still boggles my mind. I'm not quite sure I've wrapped my head around like the actual math part of that. But it's, you know, pretty interesting because it's not, you're looking for people who aren't just in California, people who never called California, you know, their home state, but many of the boxers who I ended up reaching were California residents.
And just to confirm, they're automatically put in. There's no application form for them to.
No, it's not an opt-in or an opt-out type of pension. The it's completely based on how many fights you have in California. The commission logs that information, and they have accounts for 1,900 boxers currently. Now, not all of those 1,900 are guaranteed benefits. Those are just how many boxers currently have accounts, and should they reach the 75 rounds or and not with the with no more than that 3-year break, because that 3-year break is kind of a critical thing. Many boxers lose their pensions because they're not fighting the 3-year. They have too long of a break in between their rounds. So that's something the commission is actually actively looking at erasing right now. There are regulations that they have put forward that would get rid of their, it's called a break in service. And that would be moving forward. It wouldn't be retroactive, but so there are those 1900 boxers are not obligated to be told by the commission that they have a pension, but the commission is attempting to tell them that, you know, that they create these accounts for them. But I think, you know, in the reporting, it's very clear that they're not doing a good enough job.
And just to clarify again, so say they have to box 75 rounds, or their fights have to just have been scheduled 75 rounds. I was going to say, because if you're like Deontay Wilder, that's like 75 first round knockouts.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's a very good clarification. Yes. It's not 75 rounds total. It's that's how many rounds you were scheduled.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask that question, but Mike beat me to it, because that is a very important detail, because it's true. There's some fighters who are not, how we call them, knockout artists, and they finish their fights within 2-3 rounds. But that's a very important detail to say. As long as whatever is scheduled for 10-12 rounds, that's what contributes towards that pension plan. Who would you say out of over the dozen fighters that you spoke to in regards to this investigation, Melody, who had, I guess, the most surprising reaction to the information that there was money out there for them?
I think it was the Jennifer Alcorn. She's a Fresno fighter. She, you know, 18-0 in her fights. Really interesting story behind her. Like, she had like a late start to boxing, got into boxing at 27. You know, pretty interesting woman. And her reaction was just, you know, holy shit. Like, I mean, it was just like, like, she had no idea that she had this money. And I think those were the reactions that were always the most surprising, because if you go on the Athletic Commission's website, you can see that there is a pension, and, you know, and a lot of the fighters I talked to just said, like, I, there was a rumor about this pension. Mm-hmm. And then like, they had all kinds of theories. Like, you know, I thought that thing, you know, never got funded. I thought that, like, you know, that it was fake. That was one of the reactions. And so I think that was always the most surprising, is like the fighters genuinely had no idea this money was there, because there were a lot of fighters who knew the money was there, but didn't know how to apply or when to apply, and just assumed eventually they would. But that's not how those regulations work either. The commission wants you to apply at 50.
Is there anybody that you would have liked to have spoken to that either you couldn't get a hold of, or just chose not to be in the article?
There's a lot of fighters I talked to who didn't want their information in the story. So there are quite, you know, a lot of fighters I talked to who didn't want the amount or like their backstory or things like that. I think one of the more interesting ones, and I'm trying to remember, Kiko, the fighter
Martinez?
That died. No, the fighter, he died in the 80s. Was fighting Davila. I'm just totally blanking on his name. Benji's, I think. But I think that's one of the fighters, because I remember the story, reading the story, and it was all over the place, right? Like when he died in the shortly after leaving the ring, and the New York Times had stories, and it was like a big deal at the time. And I remember reading a line in his obituary that his wife was pregnant. And the fact that his money is just sitting there, I just, that was one of the ones who I really wish I had been able to find an adult daughter at this point to say, hey, your dad actually had money like set aside for him.
Francisco Kiko Behinas.
Yes.
So Melody, you, cause I know there's a different numerical figures within the story. How much, as of your investigation to date, how much money is out there that's unclaimed right now?
It's different. I mean, for unclaimed, that's 2.1 million. And the commission, that's the money for fighters that are 54 and above, because the commission's rules have a timely claimant is between 50 and 53. And at 54, they take the money and they redistribute it. And they set a very small amount of money aside for boxers who then come back late, and claim it. So that amount of money is like the unfunded liability part of the pension that I have highlighted in my stories, because it's, you know, in the boxers I talk to alone, they don't have enough money to cover even those claims for the boxers that have put in claims most recently. And when I say they don't have enough money, it's not enough money without taking away from other boxers, right? Like they're going to have to change the pension plan. And then because it is a defined benefit, or sorry, defined contribution plan, nothing owed to boxers is guaranteed until they turn 50. That's the only point in which you're locked in on your benefits. But even then, there is no obligation for the state to pay that amount. They've never not paid an amount once a boxer turns 50. They've paid that throughout, but there's nothing in the state that says that they have to, because it's however much is in the money. It's similar to like a 401k, you know, however much is in your account when you retire, that's what you're obligated, or that's what you get.
And then in terms of, I know there was a detail in your investigation, that touched on, the California Commission had addresses that were 20, 30, you know, years old, 40 years old, 20 years old, for some of these fighters. But you know, people always move, and they're not in those residences anymore. They could be in another state. They could be in another country. I know one fighter, I think you spoke to, lived in Canada. Is that something, we know you had some contact with the executive officer of the California State Athletic Commission, Andy Foster, who's been on our show multiple times before. Can you tell us about, you know, the conversations you had with somebody like Andy Foster or any other representatives of the commission?
Yeah, I lost track of how many hours Andy spent on the phone, on Zooms with me, going over the details of this plan. And, you know, I think Andy is very dedicated to finding these fighters. And, you know, I think it's important to note that he also came in, and, you know, the pension system has given out 4 million to date. And of that, 3 million has come under Andy Foster. So I think that the pace has certainly picked up, but I think that the story really points out that there are ways in which the commission can do better at ensuring that people who are owed pensions know that they're owed pensions. And one of the easiest ways that pension experts are saying to do that is to ensure that you're sending statements to boxers the moment they vest. And that's something that state auditors have said for years about this specific pension, is that typically with most other pensions, you know, in the employer realm, like you're receiving a statement every year. And that's as much to tell you about what you're owed as it is for them to know that they have current addresses and that you're up to date on, you know, what your benefits are when you retire, so you can plan accordingly. And so that's one of the biggest issues I think that the pension experts have really pointed out with this specific boxer's pension, is that they wait until a boxer turns 50 and then they're trying to find them. And then in addition to that, I mean, I will say that list that they had, many of those fighters were really not that hard to find. Many of them still lived in the cities that were listed on their boxing profile when they fought. So, you know, doing a search and finding somebody who is still in the same city with a, you know, with the information they have, they have first and last names, not always spelled correctly, but you can look it up and get the correct spelling. They have middle names and they have birth dates. And that really is enough to find many of these fighters who were owed benefits.
Did you raise that with Andy, the part about sending out statements, which would obviously make the fighters aware?
I did. We talked at length about it, and I'm not quite sure I ever really understood like what the answer was in terms of, I mean, he just said that their policy was to reach out once they were owed benefits. So I'm not quite sure why they haven't done that earlier. I don't know if that's administratively burdensome. I think that the pension administrator would be the one, not the commission itself, that would send those out. And maybe that might be cost prohibitive. I mean, you don't want to charge too much to the pension and take away benefits too. So there isn't a balancing act. I mean, even hiring a private investigator, Andy said that he wanted to use the commission's funds, and coming out of the pandemic, you know, I've seen how much money they've lost, and, you know, it was pretty incredible that they're still building back.
Can you, I'm glad you touched on that, because that's something that I had in my notes to ask you about. Because obviously COVID affected a lot of live sports, especially combat sports in California. And there's numerical figures that you have in your stories regarding that. Could you kind of give us a comparison of how the pandemic affected those numbers and now how they're, I guess, essentially rebounding?
Yeah. You know, Andy had said that this year's budget was, I think it's $1.9 million. And at their height, I think it was 2.6, if I'm remembering right. And that was like, I think 2019. So at their worst, they were, I mean, that's them rebounding. They're not where they were before the pandemic yet. And the amount that they went down was pretty significant, you know, and that impacted the pension, which is, you know, ticket sales is how that is funded. So it's an 88 cent ticket fee, with a max gate per event of 4,600. And so when there were no events or there weren't as many tickets allowed to be sold for events, you know, the amount going into the pension went from, you know, roughly $100,000 each year to, I think it was 2021 that it dropped down to 52,000. So it's a pretty significant cut in revenue for the pension itself.
Right, right. And then I think we touched on earlier in the interview, Melody, I don't think there's current legislation, but there's, you know, discussions of trying to create a pension plan for the MMA world, mixed martial arts. Did you get any update on that from Andy Foster?
The commission has been pretty dedicated to this and this, you know, building an MMA pension. Andy had really talked about, it's about equity, that to regulate combat sports and offer a pension to only one type of fighters, you know, to him felt fundamentally unfair, especially when he, you know, there's very similar outcomes for some fighters at the end of their careers, where you are giving up your, you know, prime working years, your college years, like in order to invest in your career. And at the end, if you don't have the education or the job set, job skills, like, it can be a really hard transition for a lot of guys. And to be able to build this, you know, money at the end of your retirement to help make up for whatever you might have lost during those years, I think it was his argument was, you know, that that's what the state should be doing, taking care of the fighters that are entertaining us and making sure that they can retire comfortably. And so that bill is in the legislature now. I've gone to a couple of the committee hearings and it has sailed through unanimously, wildly supported in the legislature, bipartisan. And it was supposed to come up in the assembly today, or it could have come up as early as today for a full vote in the assembly, but it didn't come up today. So it now could come up as early as Thursday.
One thing I didn't realize until I was looking today when I knew you were coming on the show is at the age of 36, they can actually change the pension into vocational credits, I think it's called. Well, obviously they can go to school, get a trade, get a degree or something like that. What did you think of that?
Yes. And you can also, that's one part of it. And then you can also, there's medical, you can actually apply for your pension early if you have a medical reason, a demonstrated medical reason. You know, with the vocational education, I feel like that's another reason that telling boxers when they vest so that they have all of their options on the table, that they know this is the amount that I'm, you know, I have in this account. Here's when I can use it. And I did hear from a couple boxers who said, you know, I might have actually used that had I known. I struggled with careers. And so I think that that's another reason, like making sure boxers know from the moment they vest, that here's your, you know, you have a pension and here's the ways in which you can use it. The other thing is that beneficiaries are allowed to get a pension. So if once a boxer dies, that money is eligible for their family. And that there are very few, I think there's 10 total claims that have ever been paid out to a beneficiary.
Going back to Andy Foster, Melody, and obviously we appreciate your valuable time here on the last round. There was one quote that we thought was kind of funny, because we're a part of the quote that he told you where he said, I was trying to find it, but in a sense he says that he's been on essentially every boxing radio show, every boxing show there is, talking about this stuff. And he's been on with us, what, Mike, maybe two or three times, and he's talked about it every single time. So in that regard, he has been attempting to reach the boxing public. But you're right that a lot of the casual audience and the casual public aren't aware of this benefit. But we thought that was kind of amusing that he said, so yeah, I've been on all these boxing shows, and he really has, because we're a part of that quote. But also, you know, what kind of changes have you seen implemented after this investigation, or after the commission was made aware that you guys were looking into this?
The most immediate one was the list of boxers on their website. At one point, the list that had been on there for years stopped at the letter S for last names. And so they just had cut it off prematurely in that list. And it was also creating confusion among boxers who were going on there and seeing that their name wasn't on there and assuming that they weren't qualifying for those benefits, including boxers that were 50, because they had only previously put boxers once they turned 54. And it was a very dated list. So they did update those lists. Those are more complete right now. And I think that has the potential to really improve, you know, the number of boxers filing claims, and not just for the boxers who are owed late claims, but also for like timely claims. The boxers who are turning 50 or between the ages of 50 and 53 and can see that they're owed those benefits before they have that whole forfeiture rule go into effect and they have to file late claims in order to get their money. And so that's one initial thing. The story also hits on, there's a lot of disputes on whether or not the pension is supposed to be increasing each year by cost of living increases, by CPI. And that is something, when you read the actual statutory language, it very much, to my eye, sounds like it's very clearly saying they were supposed to be increasing by CPI every year to ensure that the pension doesn't depreciate over time. Because a person who is getting a pension today, the value is the same as it was to a guy who could have gotten it two decades ago, because they're not increasing the amount that's going into the pension. And so one of the architects of the pension, Bob Felmuth, had said the same thing, like they are supposed to be increasing this. He had tried, there's several letters saying that he had written when he had worked on the legislation that created that that CPI benefit. And it has never been done. Auditors have pointed it out too. The commission at one point was looking at increasing the ticket fee or any kind of revenue by CPI, but it fell off in between the trend when Andy came on, right before he came on, that there was obviously a lot going on with the commission in 2012. And it just seemed like something happened and it just never got picked up again. And so the commission did tell me that they were going to review their decision and whether or not they need to be looking at that again. So that'll be interesting on whether they look at that and decide that they should be increasing, you know, to ensure that there's inflation increases on the pension revenue side.
So that in touching on that, pension revenue obviously comes from various sources, but one of them, like you just mentioned, comes from tickets for these boxing matches. Right now it's at 88 cents, right? For the ticket fee. And it says in your article that there was discussion about raising it to $1. You did speak to a California promoter, Alex Campanovo, who is a promoter for Thompson Boxing Promotions down here in Southern California primarily. And I kind of just want to read this and then kind of get your take on that discussion you had with him. It says, California boxing promoter Alex Campanovo said, increasing the amount companies like his have to pay will be a tough sell. Campanovo said the boxing industry is still reeling from the COVID-19 shutdowns, and promoters are already paying high taxes and other fees in California. And then he says, quote, it all adds up in the end. What was your reaction to that? Because it's true that, you know, there's Thompson Boxing Promotions is a more regional boxing promotions in California. Obviously, there's national and global promotions. Obviously, those are the bigger players in the sport. But for somebody like his company, they would probably feel that a little bit more than the bigger players. What was your take on that conversation you had with him?
I think that there is, you know, it's still unclear whether they would increase the cap too. And it does sound like, because the MMA pension, that's still part of the discussion, is like, is there a cap on the MMA pension? Or is it just a ticket fee? Whereas the boxer's pension has that cap of 4,600. And I think that's probably the bigger issue for most promoters is, you know, if you increase that substantially. But, you know, I think that, you know, when you look at the numbers for boxing events over the last couple of years, that was a really tough time for all live events. And so I can understand like where he's coming from. And it does sound like the commission is moving forward with that, with increasing it to $1. But in my conversations with Andy, and also in some of the materials that they have online for their board materials, they're also looking at other revenue sources for both the MMA pension and the boxer's pension, specialty license plates and, you know, other things along those lines that could create revenue streams that aren't just, you know, being paid by promoters.
So for any past or present fighters that are currently listening to this, Melody, what is the one thing that you want to leave them with in regards to this investigation?
I think it's to get the word out, like checking the list, seeing if your name's on there. And if it's not, you know, calling the commission or emailing the commission and double checking to make sure if you think that you qualify, you should be. These are benefits that were set aside in your name. They're, you know, they're owed to these boxers. And I think it'd be great if more boxers were able to see it and share the information and benefit from a program that very clearly was, you know, created for them.
Obviously, Millie, you touched on, you chose this as your investigation. Now that you've finished it, was it in a better or worse place than when you started?
I don't know that the changes have been significant, so far, but I remember talking to Andy Foster at one point and him telling me that like one of the greatest things that you can do is call somebody and say, oh, hey, we've got this money for you. And I had told him, I was like, it is a pretty great feeling to call somebody and be like, hey, are you aware that there's this money for you? Like, I mean, as reporters, we often call people with bad news. Like this was not a bad news phone call, like for the people that I was reaching out to. But I think it would be great to see the program be able to ensure that boxers can plan ahead, and know that this is money that they can use. You know, the regulations that allow for the vocational education, I think that that is something that more boxers, should be aware of, that they could, it could help them with the transition after leaving the sport. And, you know, ultimately when I went back to the state archives and I read sort of the intent of what this pension was supposed to do, and the grand plans that they had of helping vulnerable boxers, at a time in the 70s and early 80s when there were a lot of stories of boxers ending up on the street and, you know, the impact of boxing injuries. So I think that was sort of my takeaway, is just watching somebody with dementia who needs this money. And I highlight one of the stories in the in my story of a guy who, you know, is relying on friends and sleeps on a massage table he found in an alley. And it's only $8,700 that set aside for him, but that's a lot of money for him. And he, it means a lot to him, like that. And the fact that it's coming from boxing, like at a stage in his life, he's 69 and, you know, was looking at this money as like boxing, like remembers me, boxing has something for me. And I thought that that was just very, touching.
And California is the only state in the United States that has any type of program like this for boxers, right?
It's the only state administered one, yeah.
Okay. Have you, in your research and your investigation, did you touch on any other states with potential, you know, maybe they're potentially looking into programs like this?
Over the years, there have been states that have proposed different boxers' pensions, but none of them have done anything. And there was a national push at one point in the mid-90s led by John McCain. I went back and listened to a lot of those congressional hearings. And I talked to one of the senators who was involved at the time about, you know, what ended up happening. And, you know, it never came to be for a national pension. But I think that that is one important thing to point out, is that when California created this pension, the reason that they didn't attach a lot of money to it was because they always assumed other states would join in, that they would lead, other states would join in, and suddenly, like, you could build an actual retirement account, because this isn't enough for anybody to retire on. This is, you know, they call it a pension, but it's a lump sum payment that, you know, averages $17,000. That's not going to get you through retirement by any means. But when the state created it, their intention was that all states would kind of see the benefits of this and jump in.
17 grand's not getting you far in California.
No, not at all.
It's not. Well, Melody, we definitely appreciate your time here on the last round. Hopefully not the last. If you ever do any other sports investigations, obviously boxing, we're a boxing podcast. you're more than welcome to reach back out to us, or we'll reach out to you and get you back on so you can reach the boxing public on our show. But before we end the show here, go ahead and let our listeners know where they can find you, Twitter, any type of social media. And if you have anything upcoming in the LA Times, go ahead and plug it.
Yeah. So I'll continue to follow the MMA pension bill throughout the legislature. You can find me on Twitter at Melody Gutierrez. And my email is always open. If you have questions or need information on the boxer's pension, my email is melody.gutierrez@latimes.com. And yeah, happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Awesome. Mike, like we always do, go ahead and let them know where they can find us and follow us.
We're at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter.
And obviously, we have a show coming up next week. We're like a lot of big fights, undisputed matchup coming up this weekend as well. I know we already touched on, but we're going to touch on more as the weeks come by. But once again, big thanks to our guest of the week in LA Times investigative reporter Melody Gutierrez. For my co-host Michael Shepard, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast. Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is the Last Round Podcast.